BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello. Later, the long-promised catch-up on your responses to our major interviews with the CEOs of the RNIB and Guide Dogs. But first, as technology seems to be impinging on more and more aspects of our lives, it's surely becoming increasingly crucial that blind and partially sighted people get better access to websites, apps, phones, methods of dealing with money. The list is endless. So here's the good news. The European Accessibility Act, the EAA, is on its way. It kicks in next month. And the bad news? Well, it's EU legislation, so not strictly speaking directly applicable to the UK. But before you switch off, there's a silver lining to that cloud, which my guests will explain. Joining me are Leonie Watson, who's director of Tetralogical, which is an accessibility consultancy and auditing company, and Antoine Faube. He's head of advocacy and campaigns with the European Blind Union. Let's start with you, Antoine. Just in a nutshell, explain what this legislation will do for visually impaired people in the EU.
Yes, the European Accessibility Act, it obliges companies to make a range of products and services accessible for persons with disabilities in general. It concentrates on a wide range of products and services. These are, I'll mention a few, computer general purpose, computer hardware systems, and operating systems, for instance, Windows or Mac OS, payment terminals, self-service terminals, including, for instance, ticketing machines and ATMs, consumer terminal equipment, for instance, smartphones, tablets, e-readers, for instance, Amazon Kindle, some services too, for instance, electronic communication services or services providing access to audiovisual media services.
We'll come back to some of those. How effective do you think it's going to be in EU countries? And I mean, I will come to the UK implications with Leonie, but as far as EU countries, how much difference do you think this is going to make?
If all the effects of the new legislation effectively translate into practice, it's going to make a very big difference, because nowadays products and services are far from being accessible for visually impaired people. In practice, there will be delays. I don't expect there to be a huge change from 28 June. First of all, many businesses we know are still in the early stages of preparing for the European Accessibility Act and will not be ready by the end of June. And the European Accessibility Act relies on supporting standards at European level to confirm that the accessibility requirements are met. And these standards will not be equally available across the EU and depending on sectors.
Let me bring in Leonie Watson. Now, I think it's a fair bet that we wouldn't have asked you on if this had no relevance to people in this country. So just explain how it could affect us.
So the sad news is that it won't have a direct impact on blind and partially sighted people in the UK, unless you happen to be buying a product from within a European Union country. The silver lining, as you described it earlier, is that I think we can be reasonably sure that a lot of organisations who are selling products and services within the European Union won't want to treat the UK as an entirely separate market, because if you have to maintain two different versions of your product or two different versions of your website, you know, that adds overhead and expense. So what I'm personally hoping, and I'm sure many others are, is that we'll see a ripple effect come down out of this legislation.
So you mean that if they're going to make some things more accessible than they were, there'd be no point in having two versions of it, would there?
Certainly not, unless for reasons they're maintaining two versions already.
I mean, give me an example of the kind of thing we might be talking about here.
Well, Antoine mentioned audiovisual streaming services, you know, Netflix, any number of other platforms that we use for watching streaming TV. There's a good chance that the changes they're making in order to make sure their platforms conform to this legislation within France, Germany, other EU countries, it'll be the same service that we get here in the UK. So any improvements in accessibility they're making for one audience, there's a fairly good chance, I imagine, we'll see that kind of ripple out to the UK audiences too.
Just staying with you for a moment, Leonie, I mean, we've been hearing a lot lately, especially this last week, from our government about what it's describing as a realignment with Europe without actually rejoining the EU. What do you think is the likelihood of the government implementing something like this in the UK?
I honestly don't know what the likelihood is, but I very much hope that they will. There was a European directive several years ago now that related specifically to the public sector. And even though that was enacted after the Brexit vote went through, also before the actual hard decisions and the deadlines passed, you know, we do have that now part of UK legislation. So part of me remains somewhere optimistic, hopeful that, that we will at some point adopt this or something remarkably similar.
The problem here is actually, and perhaps I can put this to Antoine and then to you, the problem here is actually who brings the cases where companies are not actually obeying the law because it's too expensive for individuals and organisations don't seem that willing to take up the baton, do they?
I would say it's for civil organizations, civil society organizations to act as watchdogs and bring cases to the attention of governments. So there is a role for organizations such as the European Planning Unions, its national members and other umbrella organizations at EU level to see to it that the EU rules are being respected and they will begin to actually flag misapplications of EU law.
Just staying with you for a moment, I'd like to ask you about some pretty down-to-earth things. Certainly, we've talked a lot on this programme about the difficulties people have, for example, in paying for goods now with sort of flat screens, and also a lot of just ordinary household machines like dishwashers and washing machines have got this sort of buttons which are inaccessible, becoming inaccessible. Do you think this will have an effect on those?
Oh, absolutely. And it's a very good point, actually, something ABU is looking at very carefully. The European Accessibility Act addresses payment terminals. It does not, unfortunately, address the accessibility of household appliances. When it comes to payment terminals, manufacturers will have to adapt their products to make sure that even if they use flat screens, touch screens, there will have to be an alternative for blind people. And we will be campaigning hardly for the legislation to also address the gaps in EU legislation, namely household appliances, but also public urban transport and other things. But the Accessibility Act will make a huge difference for many products.
Right. I just wonder how long it'll take. Leonie, can I put the same thing to you? Would you see this having an effect? Presumably some of this equipment is made not in the UK, but in EU countries.
Yes, again, like Antoine said, I think the most likely area we'll see improvements will be in payment terminals and other self-service kiosks. Sadly, not the fronts of our washing machines and microwaves and such. It is worth mentioning, though, that the EAA has a 5-year grace period built into it. That's on top of the 5 years warning people have already had since the directive was actually enacted back in 2019. So, you know, we're unlikely, especially with the hardware production side of things, I think, to see radical changes very quickly.
Well, Leonie Watson, thanks for coming on and cheering us all up. And Antoine Faube, thank you too. Thank you. Now, something which is also all about access, audio description, the process of putting into words aspects of life with a large visual content. TV, film, stage plays, stately homes. It's becoming increasingly prevalent, but how many of us knew there was an audio description association and that it wants more blind and partially sighted members to join to help shape the future of audio description? Yusuf Osman is one of the association's trustees. So Yusuf, what does the association do?
So the Audio Description Association has been around for about 25 years. I only joined about a year and a half ago because, like a lot of people, I hadn't heard of it either. It was set up to improve the standards of audio description. So its membership has always been audio describers, companies that produce audio description, and blind and VI individual members. We want to increase the number of blind and VI individual members because the best way of improving the standards is by hearing what those who use audio description think about audio description. And this year we've launched a new group specifically for blind and VI people to talk about their experiences of audio description. And one of the things that audio describers have told me over the last, well, 15 years, I'd say, since I started going to audio describe theatre a lot, is they don't get feedback. And there might be many reasons for that, some of which are to do with not providing people with a method to give that feedback. But also, I think there are concerns amongst us, the user, that if we say we didn't like this or this didn't do what we needed it to do, it might get taken away. But actually, audio describers want that feedback, and this user group is exactly the way we hope people will be able to give it.
And I think there's an offer to encourage more people to join, more visually impaired people to join. Can you tell us about that? Is it still open?
It is still open, yeah. We still have several dozen memberships left. We had a generous donation to have up to 100 blind or VI people join for free. Usually the annual individual membership for a blind or VI individual is £10, but for this year it's free for those 100 people. If people are interested in joining, go to the website, which is audiodescription.co.uk/join-ADA. And if you have any difficulties, contact Trish, who is our wonderful membership secretary, on membership@audiodescription.co.uk.
Just one other thing, Yusuf. I mean, just speaking personally, are there aspects of audio description that you'd like to see improved?
Yes. Physical descriptions. There seems to be a tendency now to avoid describing hair colour, body shape, body size, whether somebody has a visible disability. Now, I've been blind since birth, and my family come from Cyprus. And I never quite knew where I fitted in terms of skin colour. Am I brown? Am I white? And I'm sure there are other blind people who don't know these things because they've never seen them. So if somebody doesn't tell us these things, at best, we don't know about it and we don't think about it. And at worst, we go around thinking that people are something when they're something else. The other big thing for me at the moment is pre-recorded audio description and the potential for AI to get into audio description. If you go to some of the big theatres up in London, Hamilton's a good example of this. You can go to any showing of Hamilton you want to, and you can listen to the pre-recorded audio description, which is great in one way, because you can go to any performance. But in another way, you're not actually getting an audio description of the performance that's happening in front of you.
Mm.
Because theatre changes, doesn't it, from day to day?
Yeah, I'm sure there are lots of other examples, and actually we'd like to hear about them from listeners. Yusuf Osman, thank you very much indeed. Now, ever since our interviews with the CEOs of the RNIB and Guide Dogs about their strategies for the future, we've had a steady stream of emails in response to various things raised in them. As promised, here's a sample. Retired blind rehabilitation officer Alan Maybert was dissatisfied with RNIB CEO Matt Stringer's answers to some of my questions.
His responses to the questions put to him were an attempt to justify and convince us that during his 6 years, he has made the charity more fit for purpose. If his goal was to have no blind people in senior management posts, make blind employees with many good years service redundant, and make us think of contacting the RNIB only as a last resort rather than in the first instance, the CEO and trustees have, regretfully, achieved their purpose and legacy. We all know there are blind people eminently qualified with relevant professional experience to lead major blind charities. Could it be that the recruitment agencies involved with filling these key roles simply choose to look the other way because they lack the insights to know what is required in order to facilitate and implement policies that can make a positive impact on the lives of blind people?
And this, more sympathetic to the RNIB, but only just.
While I feel sorry for the travails that the RNIB, like many other charities, are going through, I was unconvinced by some of the interviewees' answers. As we all know, the unemployment level among visually impaired people is shocking, and that while the nature of jobs being undertaken by those in work has changed over the years, the actual percentage of people in work hasn't changed at all. Mr. Stringer, in my view, offered no credible answer in relation to the 16 members of staff who were made compulsorily redundant. It would be interesting to know what steps were taken to find alternative jobs within RNIB. What help has been offered to help the 16 find alternative employment? And what the success rate is? While Mr. Stringer is entitled to make his life choices in the same way as the rest of us, I think it gives a bad, or at least an unfortunate impression if he leaves, just when the reforms he has championed are coming into effect.
Those views from visually impaired former judge, His Honour John Lafferty. Meanwhile, Hazel Dudley, who's totally blind and has had mixed experiences with guide dogs, is one of those who feels that as a result of new attitudes, the bar for being given a dog has been raised and that it's now more a question of fitting the person to the dog rather than the dog to the blind person.
In 2021, I was informed that the trainer could not recommend me to be put on the waiting list for a new dog, as I did not need one. Apparently, new rules said that each guide dog owner has to walk for at least 40 minutes for 5 days a week with the dog on a harness. When I was young, I understood that if a dog could entice you out of your four walls, and indeed assist in doing so, then you could have one. But apparently not nowadays. The partnership numbers have decreased. Well, I rest my case.
Paul Nichols picked up on the CEO's answer to my question about the impression that there was a reluctance to train totally blind people. He said one of their academy trainees had said he hoped he'd have the chance to do this before his training ended.
That in itself is quite an amazing statement. Perhaps if guide dogs actually prioritise totally blind users, this could easily be arranged. My wife was on the waiting list for a replacement dog for over 2 years before she trained with her new dog in January. I start training with a new dog next week, and by the time I qualify, it'll be 2 years since my last dog left me. We're both totally blind, would be willing to travel anywhere for training, and happy to be trained by a keen apprentice. What's their problem? It's far easier for them to train partially sighted people, especially where they have dogs that need support.
But Simon Morris, a largely satisfied guide dog owner of 27 years, introduces a rather different element to the debate.
I know not everyone's experience has been the same. I do, however, find it of concern the level to which discussions, especially from service users, are often framed with a sense of intensive entitlement and expectation of services, without always acknowledging the pressures and limits charities face. Guide dogs offering you a dog is not a right. Having to wait a long time is frustrating, but getting it right is more important than having to wait. While we shouldn't feel that we must always be grateful, I do believe we have a shared responsibility to partner with the charities that support us and to give back where we can. It's important to understand that charities often step in where public services fall short, and they're not immune to financial pressures. Criticism without support can be counterproductive. Instead, I hope we can all reflect on how to contribute, whether through fundraising, volunteering, or simply offering understanding.
Well, that's all we have time for today, but I should say we're getting exceptionally large responses at the moment, about which we're delighted. We read them all, and because you haven't heard your contribution yet, that doesn't mean it's not valued, and you may hear it soon. Keep your comments and questions coming. Email in touch at bbc.co.uk.